Okay. The reason I chose to veer a little bit from a Gemara share is because in Parshas Yisro, which will be this Parshas, the Shabbos, and Mishpatim, which I won't be here for, there are two different presentations of Parsinai that are very different, and they allude to two very different aspects of our relationship with Hashem, and I thought that these are things people talk about a lot, and they reference them, but they don't really get down and drill under the hood and try to define them. So I wanted to talk with you about them, and we'll see what they are in a moment. Let's first see the Pesukim. In Parshas Yisro, we read a lot about distance and boundaries and not getting close, and if you get closer, you're going to die, and if even an animal will die, and you'll get skila, which is a very frightening introduction to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is the first communication with Hashem, and all they hear about is V'hig baltasa amsa vivle mar, make sure they keep away. He's a herb bahar negar bekatseo, don't touch the mountain. Kalanoge bahar mos yumas, losiga boyad kisako yisakel, o yaro yere, embe ma imishlo yechia. See, this is some very, very frightening psukim. And then they wake up the next day, bahar sinai ashan kulo, the mountain is billowing in smoke, vayacharat kol ama sherba machaneh, and they're terrified. And then, haikala shofar halech vechazek meod, Moshe daber, velokim yanen bakol, loud sounds and smoke and fire, vayacharat ahar, and then now the mountain's shaking. There's a lot of fear and smoke and distance and mystery and unknown and keep away. Whereas when you read Mishpatim, and since you don't have the Sukkim in front of you, I'm not going to go into them now, but the Sukkim and Mishpatim give a very, very different view of Har Sinai. In the end of Mishpatim, you'll see next week in Mishpatim, you obviously can open it this week as well, but in the end of Mishpatim, there's another scenery of Har Sinai. And there's a machlokas we've shown him. Is it the exact same depiction chronologically, the exact same Har Sinai just presented two different ways? Or there are different stages of Har Sinai. But for the purposes of this year, it doesn't make a difference. Because even if it's a different stage, Hashem is clearly presenting two different views of Har Sinai, stage one and stage two. Certainly, if they're the same moment in Har Sinai, then the Torah is providing different angles of Har Sinai. And in the second presentation of Har Sinai in Parshas Mishpatim, they bring karbanos, and they build a matseva, and they have dam, and there's a bris, and they eat, and they drink, and they see Hashem, and he looks like blue sapphire in the whitest sky. These are all the psukim in the end of Mishpatim. Parshas Mishpatim ends with them seeing Hashem. These two sections, the section in Yisro, contrasted with the section in Mishpatim, highlight the two emotional interfaces we have with Hashem. Namely, there are three mitzvahs. There are three categories of mitzvahs. Most mitzvahs are mechanical mitzvahs. You don't have to think anything. You just have to perform an action. Now, obviously, the more you think, the deeper the action, the more symbolic, the more resonant. Sorry, you can share the sheet. Okay, the more symbolic the action. But we pass in mitzvos ein tzichas kavana, which means that if I eat most mitzvahs, if I eat matzah, if I pick up a lulav, if I sit in a sukkah may be different, and I have no clue what the mitzvah symbolizes. I just know Hashem wants me to eat matzah. Well, matzah is different because of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. But let's say lulav. So I have no clue what a lulav is. I have no clue what a symbolism is. I look at my watch. Uh-oh, it's Tesbav Tishrei. Hashem wants me to take a lulav and dalet minim. I pick it up. I'm yotze the mitzvah. The more that I identify, the greater the symbolism, of course, the deeper the experience. But legally, I perform the mitzvah because the mitzvah is purely mechanical. It's not emotional. It's not intellectual. There's a second group of mitzvahs, which is not what to do, but what to believe. So, for example, you have to believe in Hashem. You can't believe in idols. You have to believe in a mitzvah. There's certain mitzvahs of belief. It's a little harder, but you can study a belief. So if I tell you, you have to believe in something, if you know Hashem wants you to believe, okay, you know how I'll go about it, I'll study it, and being that I know Hashem wants me to believe it, it must be something I should believe in, and I can absorb the information like any other information. But then there are two mitzvahs, which are not mitzvahs of body, nor are they mitzvahs of thought, they're mitzvahs of heart, which Hashem wants us to feel two emotions towards Him. One emotion is Abbas Hashem. One emotion is Yiras Shamayim, Yiras Hashem. And those two emotions are being depicted in each respective section of Har Sinai. The first section of Har Sinai in Yisro is Yiras Shamayim. Fear, distance, cloud, smoke, mystery, keep away, you're going to die, punishment. The second section of Mishpatim tries to distill or contain Avas Hashem. Feeling close, forming a bris. A bris is always bilateral. Bringing korbanos, seeing Hashem, being happy. Avas Hashem. Now, those are very challenging mitzvahs for two reasons. First of all, how can Hashem legislate emotions? Famous question of the Eben Ezra in this week's Parsha. How can Hashem tell us, lo tachmod? If I covet something that someone else has. By the way, you're only over lo tachmod if you covet something that's exclusive. If someone has a car, and I covet his car, I don't violate lo tachmod. I just go by the same car. If he has nice sneakers, not covered sneakers, and not over l'sachma, just go buy the sneakers. It's a person's wife, it's a person's house, it's a person's something that's unique, something that's exclusive, where I can only have it if you can't have it. So I see myself as superior to you, and I feel like I should have it because I deserve it because I rate myself as superior to the person I covet. And also legally, you don't really violate the mitzvah if you covet. It's a misnomer. If you want something, even if you envy it deeply, you're not violating legally los achmod. Legally los achmod is only if you covet it deeply enough that you actually take an action to try to acquire it. Either you take it, or you try to take it. But if you don't, if you just feel deep, deep envy and deep, deep desire, it's not good. It's not a good trait, but you don't violate the legal mitzvah of los achmod. But either way, Hashem doesn't want you to covet. Even if you're not in violation of the Isur of Los Achmod, Hashem doesn't want you to desire. But how can Hashem tell me not to desire? I want that person's fill in the blank. How could I not desire it? Very famous question of the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra's answer, you know the answer?
Yeah,
it's a hard answer. It sounds a little bit aged, a little bit worn. You know, a prince and a princess and a serf can't marry the princess. And like, we don't really think in those terms because have you ever met a princess? I haven't. Have you ever met a serf? I haven't. We live in an egalitarian society of upward mobility and everyone's equal and everyone can marry anyone. So it's not like anything's off bounds. There are no limits. So it's not like I can say, oh, that's off limits. Again, it helps me because I can at least imagine that if Hashem said it's us, or then I should see it as out of my world. Like if you told me to covet an alien, let's say there was an alien, I wouldn't covet an alien because I would never get to that planet to be able to take the alien. So if I view things that Hashem prohibited as alien to me, as so far from me that they're not part of my world, maybe it can limit my desire, maybe it can limit my covetousness. But there are other ways in the modern era to try to think about. For example, I taught a Sfas Emes this week in memory of one of the Talmidim who was killed in Yeshiva who started Sfas Emes here. Sfas Emes is something which is really obvious in modern psychology. It's just it's pre-psychological because it was written about 150 years ago before we had the Freudian language. But or as the Freudian language is being popularized, he says, it's not like you want to stifle your covetousness. You just want to build deeper passions for more meaningful things, and then you'll choke the passion for trivial things. So instead of trying to stifle your passion for your friend's wife, your friend's car, for your friend's possessions, just stoke the passion for Torah, for Yerusha Mayim, for meaning, for religion, and then these things are obviously not as important, so it loses its energy, loses its oxygen, just like a big fire put out a smaller fire. Anyway, it's an interesting question, but getting back to our discussion of Avas Hashem and Yerusha Hashem, how could Hashem tell us to love him? How can you legislate emotions? I mean, I hate chocolate ice cream. You can't make me like chocolate ice cream. It's my emotional, this is my want, it's my inclination. You probably like chocolate ice cream. We're just different that way. And the second problem is, the second daunting challenge is, you know, I bet you that if you starved me from vanilla ice cream and made me eat chocolate ice cream for 10 years, I'd probably fall in love with chocolate ice cream. Problem is, Hashem isn't chocolate ice cream. You can't taste him. He's unknowable, he's unseeable, he's unfathomable. No words can describe him. So Hashem is legislating an emotion about a being that we can't even imagine, taste, or even imagine. So how does Hashem want us to love him? And we use these words so glibly and so often, Avas Hashem, and Yiras Hashem, and Yiras Shamayim. How do you work on Avas Hashem? How do you become someone who's an Oyev Hashem? What does that mean, that you love Hashem? I know what it means to love a person. I love my wife. I know what that means. I know what it means to love my children. I know what it means to love food. I know what it means to love sunset. I know what it means to love physical experiences that are part of my human world, my human condition. But what does it mean to love Hashem? If you ask me, what is Hashem? I can't describe him. So how am I supposed to love something I can't begin to describe? That's, I think, what we'll talk about today. And then maybe next week, Yiras Hashem, or 2 weeks from now, when I return, we'll talk about Yiras Hashem, because that's also important, because a lot of people mistakenly think that Yiras Hashem is fear and trembling and quaking, and that's not really the highest form of Yiras Shamayim. How do you get to the highest form of Yiras Shamayim? So I took a 2-week detour, because I really thought these were important issues, and they don't get spoken about often enough, and they rattle off of our tongues. How do you work at becoming an Oyev Hashem? So today I'm going to quote three options, two Rambams and one Gemara. Although the last two options more or less will overlap with one another, so it's really two options. The Rambam attacks this or tackles this question twice in the Sefer Yad Chazaka, twice in the Sefer Mishneh Torah. Once in Hilchos Yisod HaTorah, which he takes a much more intellectual approach, which I don't think is that successful for everyone. It's marginally successful for some people. Then Hilchos Teshuva takes a much more common approach about how you view and define religion. So let's see each way. I'll paraphrase the first approach of the Rambam, and then we'll read it together. The first approach of the Rambam is to fall in love with the majesty and splendor that you see in this world. If you look into the world, you study this world, everyone studies it differently, your lenses are different. For some it's a scientific lens, for some it's an artistic lens. Right? What do you see when you see a flower? So some people see colors, some people see pistils and stamens, little pieces of the flower. They deconstruct the flower into different parts. Some people see ecology, some people see food. So everyone has a lens by which they view the world. Some are more mathematical, some are more poetic. But either way, there's a beauty, there's a majesty, there's a sweep, there's an enormity, there's a... You look at the world that's beyond you, like when things that are breathtaking that you can't ever imagine. You're standing on the cliff looking over a huge ocean. You're standing at the North Pole. You're standing on a glacier the size of a continent. Whether you feel a poetic uprising in your heart, whether you feel a scientific surpassing sense, you study the depths of the ocean, you look into space, you look into the universe. It's called, roughly, intellectual curiosity. You look at this world and you desire to know more about the world. And you see the world, and you realize this world must have a creator, and something within you shifts. Something within you, there's an emotional shift where you let your soul be stirred by something great. Wait 1 second. Those are two steps that you have to work on. Some people have no intellectual curiosity, and if you don't have it, you have to try to work on it. Some people have it, but there's an indifference. When they see something great, they don't allow themselves to wonder, to be amazed, to be taken in by it, to be grabbed, to be enchanted. To be spirited away. Some people, they don't have curiosity at all. They're not able to even appreciate that it's grand. Some people appreciate it, but it's a dispassionate, almost clinical appreciation. Through the eyes of a scientist, rather than someone who gets excited, meaning that you're meeting something beyond yourself, we call it breathtaking, losing your breath. Some people don't lose their breath proverbially or literally. I remember about 35 years ago, I'm closer to 40. I was between years in yeshiva, and we used to learn in yeshiva till Tisha B'Av. We didn't leave yeshiva early, so we stayed till the bitter end. And for the 3 weeks between 1 year and the other year, we decided to go to England just to join a course of international students in Cambridge, study literature. So we went to Cambridge, we studied for a few weeks. And so on one of the days off, we went to Buckingham Palace. We visited Buckingham Palace. And in this palace, you saw these huge dining halls with these large, large tapestries depicting biblical imagery. I mean, these tapestries must have been, I don't know, maybe what's this? This is about 50 feet long, the wall behind you. Must have been 400 feet long, almost 9 times the size of this wall. And the heights were enormous. It was like 30 feet high. And I asked the tour guide, how was this manufactured? And he told me it took teams of 50 women 30 years to stitch this tapestry of David and Goliath or Abraham and Isaac or Jacob's ladder and just... It's gorgeous, and the color, and the imagery, and the passion, and the emotion that it evoked. And we were Yeshiva Bachrim, right in the heart of the Magadlo Masech Hashem mode, where everything was Godless Hashem. And every room was another epiphany, and every room was another excitement. I remember walking into one room, and we're walking ahead of a couple older women from Texas. I remember their names, Ines and Agnes. It was very interesting. And like we walked into a room, and we walked in, like each room was another breathtaking moment. And we walked into the room, and behind me, I heard them say, "Hey, Enos, more curtains." And I wanted to say, "They're not curtains. You buy curtains for $9.99 in Walmart. These are not curtains. These are beautiful spectacles of the human imagination. These are achievements of human poetry and emotion." And then I realized that for some people, the whole world is just $9.99 curtains in Walmart. There's nothing deeper than Walmart. There's nothing deeper than the sale at Walmart than the curtains you put on your window. And I think in today's world, there's a bit of a almost villainization of intellectual curiosity, because obviously we don't celebrate intellectual curiosity unlimited. We have to know how to draw lines. We have to know how to draw red lines in the sand. We can't write the famous favorite word of every modern Orthodox failure is the F word. Filter, filter, filter. I'm going to see everything and expose myself to everything, and then I'm going to filter. Well, you can't trust yourself to filter everything. And everyone has to learn how to draw a line somewhere. And I don't think we're good at that. I think we've bought in, we've sold out entirely to exposure and encounter and conversation, intellectual inquiry, intellectual conversation, where everything is a balance. And for some people, they apply a harsher filter, for some people, they apply less of a filter in a literal sense or in a proverbial sense, in a metaphoric sense. But to be able to see things deeply, not shallow, and to see into the life of things, to see beyond the obvious, to see beyond the shell, I wonder if that's becoming a little bit harder. The pace today is much more frenetic. You're forced to process more information at once. We used to take a long time. Our world was slower. We didn't have phones. We didn't have conversations. We had quiet. We had time. And we thought about things, and we thought deeply about things. So I think sometimes people don't want to be intellectually curious. Other times intellectually curious, but it becomes like a survey, a course, an observation, rather than an engagement, trying to find something deeper and spiritual by looking to the great beyond. When's the last time you looked into the great beyond and you felt something spiritual calling you? Whether it's an ocean, whether it's a mountain range, whether it's, looking through a telescope, thinking about the skies. That's how the Rambam describes the first route to Avas Hashem. Look at your world, appreciate its vastness, absorb its magnitude, and allow yourself to shift into a moment of euphoria and of celebration. The second shift, which I think is the harder shift. Let's just read the Rambam, then I'll answer your question. This is the Rambam in Yisod Yatara. Source number one. Hakel anichbad v'hanarazem mitzvah li'ahava oliyira. You have to fear Hashem and to love Him. Shenemar v'yaftas Hashem elokecha, the mitzvah of ahava. V'nemar as Hashem elokecha tira, the mitzvah of yira. So it's actually a mitzvah. It's not just a midah, it's actually a mitzvah. V'yaftas Hashem elokecha, lashon tzivoy. As Hashem elokecha tira, a language of tzivoy. Hechi haderech li'ahava sovira. So how do you reach ahava? And tonight we're going to stress the ahava. Bisha, here's the Rambam. She is bonein ha'adam b'ma'asav uvruav hanifloim ha'gidolim. You contemplate Hashem's creation, the beauty, the majesty, the wonder. Yerah mehem chachmasa she'in la'erech. You see unlimited wisdom. Velokates, an infinity. Miyad, hu ohev, here's the shift. U'mishabeach, u'mifa'er, u'misava. You love, you glorify, you celebrate, you yearn. Tava gedola leida Hashem agadla. You want to know who's behind it. So first you have to see it, then you have to try to desire, well, what does this mean? What's the meaning? Trying to find meaning behind this magnitude means who's the author. And why does Hashem create the universe? Why does Hashem create such beauty? What does Hashem have in mind? What is Hashem's purpose? And that's how the Rambam views the first approach to Avas Hashem. It's based loosely, if you want, on Tehillim Paraches. In Tehillim Paraches, David HaMelech says, Ki era shemecha, ma'asei etz be'osecha, yerech v'kochavim asher konanta. When I see your beauty and your stars and everything, so the Rambam loosely gathers this from Tehillim Paraches, where David HaMelech is enchanted by the beauty of our world and our universe, traces it back to Hashem, and falls in love with the artist, falls in love with the person, but the artist behind the masterpiece, the architect of the masterpiece. Yes?
Does this follow a similar trajectory to like Avraham Avinu's epiphany and
God? We don't really know. We don't really know what caused Avraham to do it. There's the only source we have as to what that moment was, that light bulb moment, is a medrash that says he saw Ibira Dolekis, a city on fire. And that's been interpreted thousands of ways by people throughout the generations. What does it mean, a city on fire? Does it mean a city of light, a city of life, a city of beauty? It could be that. It could be he saw this well-organized world that was similar to a city that was synchronized and coordinated and choreographed properly, and he saw beauty, but it doesn't sound like he saw artistic beauty. It sounds like he saw more life and more moral beauty, that a world that was delicately balanced to support life. We'll talk about Avram in a moment. I think Avram understood the other part of Hashem. He took the second route that the Rambam will describe. Because, you're all right, I don't know if you intended it, unintended consequences, Avram is the only person in Tanakh to be called an Ohev Hashem. Zera Avram Ohavi, which is the Pasuk in Yeshaya. By the way, he's also the only person in Tanakh to be called the Yirei Shamayim. So it's interesting, when we get to Yirei Shamayim, we'll have to find where he's called the Yirei Shamayim. And in a minute, we'll see why he's called an Ohev Hashem, because he unlocked the second route. Okay? That's the first route for the Rambam. But if we're being honest, even people who are intellectually curious, I'm not sure that everyone's going to get to that conclusion. Not everyone's going to get to the finish line just looking at the world and seeing space and seeing beauty and seeing oceans. You have to have a poetic soul. You have to have a spiritual nature. You have to be able to see things. I'm encouraging you to become that person, but I don't think it's legitimate for the Rambam to expect every single person to follow the route to Avas Hashem that he describes in Perek Aleph or Perek Beis of Yisod Yatara. But yet Avas Hashem is incumbent upon everyone. So the Rambam is forced to develop a separate level of Avas Hashem. The second approach to Avas Hashem is described in Hilchos Tshuva, Perek Yud. And again, I'll paraphrase it, and then we'll talk about Avram. Okay? To help me convey the point, let me ask the following mental experiment. Okay? Here's a good mental experiment. Maaseh Shabbos, Hashem comes to you in a dream, and He says, you can have 24 hours off. 24 hours, you could do whatever you'd like. Behave however you'd like. Touch whatever you'd like. Eat whatever you'd like. Just take it easy. 24-hour furlough. What would you say? I think for many people your age, I think you're still trying to find religious maturity. I don't know each and every one of you that well, but many people your age would say, why not? Like, if there's no Sarve Onesh, I'm given 24 hours without any consequence, and Hashem's given me the time to do what I'd really like to do, but I withhold myself from behaving as Hashem bandit, so this is a great opportunity. This is my chance. It's a 24-hour furlough. When you reach religious maturity, the answer is a resounding no. Like, I'm not keeping Torah mitzvahs because I feel like I have to stifle and suffocate my better interests, but I'm doing it just because Hashem banned it and I want to get to Olam Haba and I don't want onesh. I deeply believe that everything Hashem commanded me is beneficial for me. Everything He banned and prohibited is toxic for me. And not just point by point, but basically I lived enough of life to realize that Hashem's interest and my welfare are in sync. And when Hashem delivers the Torah, it's not to taunt me or to stifle me or to suffocate me, because He wants me to live the best life that I can. When I look back at the life I've lived, I imagine what it would have been like without Torah, without abstinence, without moderation, without morals, without principles, without values, without me. I feel my life would have been a train wreck. Not to say that anyone that doesn't have Torah in their life is a train wreck, but for me, Torah filled it with principles and guidance and navigational skills. Hashem gave me a roadmap about how to lead life. So Hashem told me tomorrow, I could eat chazer. I said, no, I don't want to have chazer. Like, I may want it. My taste buds may want it, but okay, now chazer is something I can't understand. But Hashem told me I could steal money. I don't want to be someone that steals money. So I don't want to be someone who looks in the mirror at an immoral crook. I don't want to be someone that acts immoral sexually. I don't want to be someone that acts immorally. I know that everything Hashem commanded is based on my interests. And therefore, I would tell HaKadosh Baruch Hu, no. I am not changing a thing, because I'm not trying to be an Oved Hashem for Schar V'Onesh. I'm not trying to stifle my interests and my desires and my wills for 85 years, 90, 120 years, and I'll get my 72 versions in heaven. This is the life that I feel is the best life that I could live. And that's why, and we'll get to the Rambam in a moment, that's why the Torah never mentions Olam Haba. You would think that something so eternal and so important should at least be mentioned once or twice, and it isn't. And you know what? It's not even referenced. Tchias HaMesim isn't explicitly mentioned, but there are reference points. One of them is Az Yashir. One day everyone will once again be resurrected and we'll sing Tashem. So Az Yashir is a reference to Tchias HaMesim. There's nothing. Olam Haba is a total blank. Why? Why does the Torah not mention Olam Haba once? The answer is Hashem doesn't want to frame Avodas Hashem, religious observance, as a sellout of this life just to get to the next world. And that's why he presents one second. Torah is presented, Torah mitzvah is presented as a standalone, self-sufficient policy, even if there won't be Olam Haba. Of course it's Olam Haba. But Hashem never mentions it because that would compromise the entire integrity of the system. And for the system to have integrity, it has to be self-sufficient and self-justifying, even without Olam Haba. So when Hashem says, V'chaim shemot tishmol mitzvah sharon ruchim tzavet shamayama, what will happen? You'll have stable society. You'll be blessed by Hashem. You'll live in the presence of Hashem. You'll have rainfall. You'll have food. You'll have society. You'll have family. You'll have order. You'll have justice. You'll have whatever it takes to make life meaningful, deep, and rich. That's, let me just finish the sentence, that ability to view religion as enhancing and ennobling of human life rather than stifling and suffocating. And I think most of you are probably at that perch already. A lot of adolescents go through that difficult time where they encounter the Yisurin and it feels like a whole series of don'ts and don't and don't and I can't and I want and it's usher and say, let me out of this trap. Let me out of this prison. I won't express myself. And as you grow older, you realize that Hashem is never saying no. Hashem is saying not now, not here, not this way. Because everything Hashem gave you has a purpose. I remember as a kid, so I didn't really have a lot of contact with girls. I went to a Haredi world, and I basically lived in an all-boys environment. But I went, on Friday nights, I went to like a co-educational oneg in my community, just to, you know, someone gave a speech, or hung out, we talked a little bit, just my outlet to meet the opposite gender. I remember once this girl came over to me, I was like 15, whatever I was, and she was crying her eyes out, something happened in her family, she was really heartbroken. And my natural instinct, just as a kind human being, which I hope to be, is I like to reach out and give her a hug or something, just to help her out. And I remember the feeling, it was 40 years ago, it was like, this feels odd, like, why does Hashem not want me to? Why does Hashem tell me I shouldn't? Like, of course. And that was the 15-year-old me, and the adult me understands sexuality a little different in a way that the 15-year-old me couldn't, and understands what contact between two people can create, and how it's, all of a sudden, it got to a different space. And as I've grown in life, I understand more about Hashem's system as you mature. And you start to uncover more and more of the synchronicity and the overlap between HaKadosh Baruch Hu's interests and human welfare. The ability to see it that way, the Rambam calls Avas Hashem. Why? As you grow older, you'll find that you don't love things that have a physical impact on you. Like when you're young, you like things that either have a physical or emotional impact. So boys, I don't know, I've never been a girl, I have girls in my family, but you know, what do adolescent boys love? Movies. Why? Because it makes their heart race. What do they love? A hamburger, because it tastes good and going down gives you a good feeling. Whatever you love, physical experiences, things that create a change in your physicality or your emotional being. As you grow older, you realize that you love things not because of the immediate response. Oh, it made me feel good, hamburger. Oh, it made me feel good, movie. Oh, it made me feel good. You love things that make you better, that give you deeper meaning, that make your life better. So, for example, I've been married for 33 years, gone on 34 years. I think why I love my wife is because she made my life so much better as a person, as a family, as a father, as a husband. So I love Rav Lichtenstein to the death. Rav Aaron didn't taste good. I never tasted his arm. It's not like it was vanilla ice cream. So I didn't love him because he had an impact on me. Like he walked in the room, oh! It's like I walked in the room, oh my goodness, like a movie. I chased him a movie. And you get that rush of excitement, same way I have with a movie. But as you grow older, I'm just thankful for him because of how much he gave me in his life. So your love starts to mature. And you start to love abstractly, not, and that's the Greek philosophers talk about how love changes from the physical to the, call it conceptual, but things that have affected your life. So if I view HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the ultimate affecter and enhancer of my life, because his system of Torah mitzvahs is the ultimate benefit for me, and he gave me the ultimate benefit, more than my wife, more than Rav Lichtenstein, more than whoever else benefited in my life, then I truly love Hashem. It's very simple. It's not like loving ice cream. It's not like loving food. It's not like loving people. It's what we call appreciation. Appreciating what Hashem did for you. And loving Hashem because of that. Because thank you, Hashem, for giving me this system that helped my life become better and more superior. That's how the Rambam describes Avas Hashem. We'll see it in a moment. And then we'll talk about why Avraham was the exemplar of Avas Hashem. Why is Avraham the embodiment of this whole system? Yes, what was your question a while back?
No, I was just going to say,
you know,
if there wasn't
a
Ramadan, there
still
is Scarve
Elnish,
but you just say that
it's a consequence. Right, but the Scarve Elnish is a result, not a reward.
Right.
Basically, you live your life the right way, so of course, you're working, you're industrious, and things happen on time, you don't waste your money, you don't waste your time, for sure, but it's even Olam Haba is not a reward, it's a result. Namely, Olam Haba is not 72 versions. That's completely, completely disassociated from this world. You know what Olam Haba is? Basically, this world. You build your spiritual self in this world, and then you continue the spiritual experience in the next world without the hindrances and obstacles that this world provides. So basically, it's what we're doing now, but without getting hungry, without being tired, without having headaches, without having financial issues, without having worries, without having tensions, without warmth. Basically, if you could just extract whatever spirituality you have in this world, you get to live that under optimal conditions, which is why developing your spiritual self is so crucial, because in Olam Haba, there's no forward progress, there's no development. Whatever you are, you're locked into that state forever. Because this is a static world. Our world is dynamic. You constantly grow. In the next world, it's static. So whatever level you reach, that becomes your skin for eternity. And that becomes your capacity for eternity, whatever you develop your spiritual self in this world. But it's not a reward, it's a result. What's the difference between a reward and a result? If I tell you, I had a hard night last night, I'm a little exhausted. If I tell you, I tell a kid, you go to sleep on time, I'll give you candy in the morning. That's a reward. There's no relationship between going to sleep and giving the kid candy. It's totally an incentivizer. If I tell you, you go to sleep on time, you have a great day tomorrow, you'll be healthy, you won't have a headache, you'll be functioning, you'll enjoy it better. That's the result. You go to sleep, and the next day is a just better day. It's a more enjoyable day than if you're exhausted. Now, why is Avram considered this? And then we'll talk about the Rambam in a minute. Avram is considered this because Avram was really the first person to discover the overlap between Hashem's will and human interest. People think that Avram wore two hats. One hat was the philosopher, and one hat was the do-gooder. He was the Ish Emuna, and he was also the Ish HaChesed. It was one hat. What Avram saw in our world, and this is the mistake that people make, he didn't see Hashem through science. He saw in science a moral spirit. Greeks look at science dispassionately. What's the science? How high the mountain? How cold? Avram looked at this world, and that's the image of Bir Dolekas, a city of light, a city of fire, and he saw how delicately it was calibrated to support life. That means Hashem wants life. If our world, whatever, I don't know the exact details, but we're X amount of miles closer to the sun, some say 1 kilometer, whatever, maybe 2 kilometers, but it's X amount of kilometers closer to the sun, we'd be incinerated. if we're X kilometers away from the sun, which is nothing in terms of space, we freeze to death. Look at Venus, look at Mars, look at all the planets around us. And not just in the planetary orbit, but the delicate ecological system and the delicate balance in our bodies. And how did this all come to be? Hashem could have created the same science, but a science that would thwart life rather than would support life. So evidently, there's a creator who likes human beings and wants human beings to prosper and wants human beings to advance and cares about human beings. Avram discovered the moral spirit of the universe, and therefore his will has to be synchronous with human interest. It can't be dichotomous. It can't be antithetical, because he's a kind God. Why would he build a world that's all carefully calibrated and delicately balanced for human welfare, and then give you a system of laws that stifle you and taunt you and suppress you? So that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's system must be enabling rather than disenabling, rather than incapacitating. So Avram discovered a spirit of chesed in this world, and that's how he discovered HaKadosh Baruch Hu, where others before him had not, because for thousands of years people thought that the gods were angry, because all they saw were punishments, expulsions, floods. They all thought the gods were angry. The gods of ancient paganism were all grotesque figures in heaven, toying with human playthings for their leisure, for their fun, casting misfortune upon them, casting death upon them, casting plague upon them, casting suffering upon them. Now, Avram was the first person to realize Hashem is not. Hashem is a mechalkel chayim b'chesed. So for Avram to be true to his word, he couldn't just speak of Hashem that way. He had to be an agent of chesed. He couldn't be the Ish HaEmunah if he weren't also the Ish HaChesed. Because he spoke about Hashem being a Baal HaChesed. So if he described Hashem as a Baal HaChesed, he himself had to be a Baal HaChesed. They weren't two hats. They were the same hat. Because if not, his message would have been hollow. And that's Avram's great legacy to most of his grandchildren. When I say most of his grandchildren, I mean Jews and Christians. And to a degree, this is where Islam has lost it, many parts of Islam. Because for Jews and Christians, both bought into this legacy, the advance and the improvement of the human condition is a divine mission. Hashem wants our world to be better. Hashem does not want human beings to suffer. And any opportunity to advance the world, any opportunity for progress, is a divine mission. It's driven by a religious impulse. If I want to find a vaccine, that's a religious mission. I want to discover, indoor plumbing, it's a religious mission. I want to solve food and world hunger, it's a religious mission. Because Hashem wants the world to prosper. And if Hashem wants the world to prosper and the world is broken, then my repairing the world in the image of Hashem is His will. So these two cultures have a drive towards redemption and improvement and progress and advance. And one of the areas that Islam lost is it became so militant, and it cast Allah as angry and vengeful, and He's happy when there's innocent people suffering. So you lose your impetus to change the world, because just because the world is awry and broken, well, that's Allah's will. Because Allah is arbitrary and capricious and doesn't really care about human beings and is judgmental and unjust. Whereas Avram's message, this is such a departure from Avram's message. Avram's message was Mechalko Chayim Mechaseh. So change your world. And that's why, more or less, over the last 800 years, Judaism and Christianity, basic Christianity, but a lot of it was fueled by Jews. So many Jews led the Industrial Revolution, Scientific Revolution, the Modern Revolution, because of this impulse to change, to advance, to improve the world, because Hashem wants me to be a doctor. Hashem wants me to find a solution to whatever problem is facing humanity, because it's in His will. This is a very, very rational and sane Avas Hashem. You don't have to be a mystic. You don't have to levitate. You don't have to go out into the forest and talk to the trees. It's just, attitudinally, how do you see religion? Do you see religion as suppressive? Do you see religion as enabling? Let's read the Rambam. The Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva, Perek Yud Halacha Aleph, source number 4. We'll start with Halacha Bey, just because I'm going to stop in about 10 minutes. 10 minutes, I've got to go. Okay, 50 minutes. Ha'ovei me'ava. Let's say someone loves Hashem. Halacha Beis. Osek b'Torah uv'mitzvos. Study Torah, fulfill mitzvos. V'holech b'nesivos ha'chachma. And you follow the ways of wisdom and of intellect. Lo mipnei davar ba'olam. Not for any external reason. V'lo mipnei yiras hara. Not because you're afraid of punishment. V'lo kidei liras ha'tova. Not because you want reward. Remember, ignore Sar Vionish. Ella, here's the five words of the Rambam. I'll tell you what he's paraphrasing. Remember we talked about the Eben Ezra needing an update because the Eben Ezra is talking about serfs and princesses? Let me tell you another statement of Chazal that needed an update in the 12th century, and you'll see the Rambam's update. The first person to articulate this theory, what I call the dream scenario, where Hashem comes to you in a dream, that's my update of the update. The first person to update or to say that was a Tana, a very, very early Tana named Antignus Ishsocho. In Pirkei Avos, Antignus Ishsocho says, it's a famous Mishnah, Al tiyu ki'avadim ha-mishamshim esarav al-banas l'kabal pras. Don't be like an Eved who serves the master just wanting reward. Elheyu ki'avadim ha-mishamshim esarav shalom banas l'kabal pras. Now that made sense for a couple hundred years when people had a fatum. So when you still had slaves and people were slaves and slavery was part of human culture, so that metaphor was very resonant. Right? The metaphor is, don't be like this slave, be like that slave. And everyone that heard the metaphor understood immediately what it was referring to. It's now the 12th century in Spain and no one has slaves. Or very few. There are slaves, but it's on the margins of society as opposed to mainstream society. So the Rambam feels the need to update. I keep telling you, sometimes when people read these old imageries, like the Eben Ezra, or I'll tell you another one I spoke about this week with the boys, if you just parrot them, but they don't reflect your reality, then they remain external to you. You don't internalize them because they're not part of your world. Or we're talking this week about how cynicism and sarcasm, we're reading a piece of Mesillas Yesharim, deflects improvement. Why? Because cynics are always able to see the flaw in everything. So any person that comes to offer input or improvement or critique or positive input, you're always trying to find the flaw in the person, the flaw in the input, and you'll reject any source of improvement, and you'll basically imprison yourself or paralyze yourself against improvement. Now, the most famous metaphor for this, which is quoted in the Mesillas Yesharim, but even in Sfarim before them, when I was in high school, I remember my Rebbe, I was a little bit cynical, my Rebbe telling me this. You know what cynicism is like? It's like oil on a shield. Okay? What do you mean, oil on a shield? Well, if you happen to know ancient military war, they would go with shields. Of course, that's a very important part of their military attire. Now, to prevent the arrows from piercing the shields, because if you shoot an arrow with sufficient force, it can pierce your shield, depending on what your shield's made of, they would lubricate it with oil. So when the arrow would hit, it would glance off of the shield. So that image is very powerful. The oil on the shield, sarcasm, is to input what oil is to an arrow. Just like the oil on the shield prevents the arrow from penetrating, lubricating yourself with cynicism against input will prevent. Yeah, but when's the last time you thought about a shield? It's not part of your jargon. It's not part of your vocabulary. It made sense in the 18th century when the Mesillas Yesharim was written. So I challenged the boys and said, who can come up with a metaphor for the 21st century to capture the problem of cynicism? It blocks out input. So one boy raised his hand and said, noise-canceling earphones. Put your earphones on your head. You cancel out the noise. You don't want to listen to anyone else. Whatever. It's important to take these ideas and think about what they mean, like everything in life. I told you so many times, the worst thing you can do when you're reading Hebrew text is translate into English. Because the translation into English is awkward. Read it, understand what it means, and give it your own word. Not a translated word. Move one abstract step away from translation. Because if you translate, it's awkward, it's clumsy. Like, what does it mean? Get a word out there. What does it mean to you? Capture it in your terminology, in your words, in your... Remember, once a boy sat with me, a long, long time ago, sits down with me, says, Rebbe, I'm having trouble with Kavanah during Kriya Shema. So I said, sure, let's sit down, let's go through Kriya Shema together. He opens up the Siddur, I said, translate for me, Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel. I said, stop with the O, you're not Irish. Okay. There's no O'Reilly and O'Neill, right? Because whoever wrote the book 400 years ago in English, the O sounded very formal. But it's 2024, who says O? Like, learn what words don't make sense and take them out. Words that have no meaning, that just hold down sentences, they block meaning. So the same thing here. Antigonus Ishsocho made a lot of sense when he said it. We understand the concept, but he wasn't just interested in a concept. He was interested in an image. That's why he gave the image of a slave. So the Rambam updated it. And my update, 800 years after the Rambam, is the dream. Hashem comes to you in a dream. It's my update of the Rambam, which is an update of Antigonus Ishsocho. Let's hear the Rambam's update of Antigonus Ishsocho. Line number two. You shouldn't serve Hashem just for a reward or to avoid punishment. Ella osa es ha'emes mipnei shehu emes. Wow. That's a powerful phrase. The best way I could abstractly translate it to you is do what's right because it's right. Internal self-sufficiency. Why am I serving Hashem? Because it's right. Why is it right? Because it's right for me. And why do I keep my health? Not because I'm afraid that I'll get up. because it's right for me. It will help my life be more enjoyable. Why do I serve Hashem? Because it will make my life deeper. Now listen, the Rambam doesn't ignore Schar. Bisof, next page. Bisof hatova lava biglala. Then Schar, see the word biglala? It's a result. It will come as a result. You'll live life the right way. Of course you'll get Schar, because the best Schar is life lived the right way. And the best way to live life the right way is to live it by the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this the Rambam calls Avas Hashem. Look at the preface of the Rambam. Hey ha'oved me'ava. This is how you are an oved Hashem. So it's not really an emotion as much as an attitude. It's not like all of a sudden you're happy, sad, angry. It's no emotional change. It's just an attitude towards religion. I don't see religion as suppressive of my life. I see religion as supportive of my life. But of course, I love Hashem for giving this to me. As I said before, the Rambam doesn't give the whole explanation, but I told you why Avram was called the Ohr of Hashem, because he unlocked that secret that Hashem was a moral spirit, and a moral spirit will give a moral system for human betterment and human improvement, not for human suppression. That's why Avram is called the Ohr of Hashem. Even though the Rambam casts this as something that's a little bit rare, that not everyone reaches, I happen to think it's more accessible than the first one. I think the first one is very intellectual. I think the Rambam is a little bit of an intellectual elitist, and he assumed that everyone could reach his level. Not out of a cockiness, just out of humility. And Wittgenstein overestimated people's capacity because of what he had accomplished. He just assumed he was a normal person. He didn't realize he was, you know, a genius. I remember once we asked Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, tell us, what would you say Bekiyas is? How would you learn a Gemara Bekiyas? What does that entail? So he very innocently said, Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos, the Rosh, the Ratan, the Torah, the Beis Yosef, the Miri. So at some point, after he defined Bekiyas for us, one of the boys said, but Rebbe, if we learn that way, Bekiyas will never finish us that way. And Rav Lichtenstein, without batting an eyelash, and it wasn't a moment of cockiness, he didn't see the body language, looked at the boy and said, I did. And that in that moment, there was no like, and I'm great. It was, if I could do it, you could do it. And of course, we can't because we don't have his intellectual horsepower. I don't think the Rambam was arrogant. The Rambam just assumed that everyone else was capable of what he was. And the answer is no. A brain like that gets developed one in a generation or a few times in a generation. But I think the second approach is one which I think is much more feasible because it's more existential. It's attitudinal. How to view religion. I don't think you have to be an Einstein to see religion that way. You just have to see the secret of the synchronicity between Hashem's will and human interest. And then you love Hashem because you realize he's given you the secret of life, the keys to life. The third way to Avas Hashem, which is a little bit similar to the first way, is the Gemara in Yoma. The Gemara in Yoma says, Yitanya, Be'avdas Hashem Lokecha, source number 6, She'shem Shamayim Misahe Eval Yadcha. Now this isn't really a recipe for achieving Avas Hashem, it's more a recipe for expressing Avas Hashem. Hashem made a very interesting feature in the human heart. Okay? Let me give you a little bit of a preview of what's going to happen to you in a few years. Okay? In a few years, Mirz Hashem, your roommate's going to look at you and say, just shut up already. Marry him. Stop talking about him. Why? Because hopefully you'll fall in love with someone. And when you fall in love with something, and it's so deep and overwhelming, you feel that your heart can't contain it. And the only way you can manage that overflow, as you can't contain how excited you are, is to share. Which is a beautiful part of sharing love and sharing excitement. It's like if you go to a good restaurant, what's the first thing you want to do? You want to share it with someone. You see, you know, it's shopping. So something really excites you. What's your first instinct? You want to share it with someone. Hashem gave you that instinct. Because the excitement and the joy is just so deep that you can't contain it. And you feel like, I have to do something with it, so I'm going to deliver it to someone else. So it's the same, you'll fall in love with someone so much, you'll tell your roommate all night and all day, they don't have to shut up or have time to hear about it. Okay? We used to like one another. We used to be good friends. Now all of a sudden, all you talk about is this person. So if you love HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then you have a desire to share some of that excitement with other people. She'shem Shemayim Yisrael V'yadcha. Now this is not primarily a recipe for achieving Avas Hashem, this is the consequence of Avas Hashem. Once you feel this way about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then you want to share it. But with everything else, consequences and causes are always circular and cyclical. Causes are consequences are causes. Namely, you're right, the ideal is to reach Avas Hashem and to express it by inspiring others. But the process of inspiring others also causes you to love Hashem more. It's a cycle. Okay, love causes inspiration. Inspiration by another causes love. And that's what the Gemara says in Yoma. Notice that the way that you cause other people to love is not by stirring speeches and inspiring lessons and didactic instruction about how to do it. It's just living your life normally and letting people see a life lived under the influence of a Kodesh Baruch Hu's Ratzah. What happens? Sheikare v'shoneh, you learn. Mishamish tamid chachamim, source 6. You help people that study Torah. Yeh maso matano v'nachas emabrios. You treat people with respect and kindness. Ma abrios almos olav. What do people say? Ashrei aviv shalim dotar. Ashrei aviv shalim dotar. Well, look at this person. Like a lot of people when they go back from Israel. You know, I've discovered the secrets of the universe. I now know the truths. I'm going to go back and hold a press conference on the tarmac and teach everyone in Teaneck where they should know. Good luck with that. Right? A better way, so you know what, if you really feel that you've discovered things and you want to share with other people, have a 10-year plan. And they grow up to be the person that others will look at and say, wow, this is the person. When I was your age, there were a lot of things that I decided, changes I wanted to make in my life, and not everyone in my life could see them and appreciate them and understand them. And I got mocked and people laughed at me. And people, I remember when I got back from yeshiva, I was davening in shul one night as a teenager, your age, and an older man came to me in shul. My Shemoneh Esrei was a little bit longer than the rest of the Shemoneh Esreis. And he mocked at me. He said, let's see if your Shemoneh Esrei is as much passion when you're my age. So I always took that as a challenge. He said, Meretz Hashem, I'm going to try. And it's not like I had any easy victories where I convinced people of my value. I just said, you know, I'm going to try to build my life based on the convictions that I believe in. And one day people may or may not take notice, but I'm not going to convince people hard-handedly and frontally, and I'm going to teach you, and I have all the answers. And it's passive. And it takes time. It takes patience. It's not going to happen overnight. You're young adults, but it's like everyone bowing down to hear what you have to say. You're making your way through life. You're building your identity. You're finding yourselves. You're moving ahead. And if over the next 10, 15 years you stick to your principles, and you become that person, all of a sudden you wake up one day and people really look at you as a role model. And role modeling is how people change their lives. Not through do this, do that, frontal instruction. You just look at people and say, oh, look at that person, the way they lead their life. Right? That's when I got to yeshiva. What changed it for me? More than any other speech, which is great role models on hand. And I said, this is the type I want to be like. And they're all serious about Torah, so I'm going to be serious about Torah also. Okay, so it's more of an expression of Avas Hashem than a generator of Avas Hashem, but it's still part of the threesome. Number one, intellectual curiosity that shifts into passion and captivation. Number two, seeing religion as synchronous with human interest rather than as antithetical or suppressive. Number three, sharing it with others. Sheshem Shemayim Messiah Vayach. Okay, we're going to have to get myself packed and get to the airport. We'll pick up on Yerusha Mayim and Mirat Hashem, not next week, because I'll still be in the States, but the week after, which will be Parshas Truma Mirat Hashem. Okay?
Thank you.
Shabbat Shalom, girl. Shabbat Shalom.
Also, we've been told to pass on the message. Gabby, who normally comes to this class for an appointment, her brother's having an interview.
Oh, yes, Sunday. I should accept him?
Yeah.
Gabby what?
Her brother's name is Rafi.
He's been dying.
Oh, is that? Oh, my goodness, I've gotten so many. I don't want to embarrass him.